I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, a look at movies and the ramp up and ride through the Reagan years. Feel-bad movies like Taxi Driver soon gave way to the likes of Jaws, Rocky, Star Wars, and the exploits of Indiana Jones. Ronald Reagan's presidency also blurred politics and cinema in a very new way. He kept up with film in the Oval Office, half-jokingly looked to Rambo for hostage negotiation tips, and quoted popular films as he talked politics. We'll speak with film critic Jay Hoberman about what the films playing at a theater near you when Reagan was president said about American identity. Our conversation starts after a short break. Think 80s blockbusters without conjuring all those one-liners that made them memorable.
Snakes. Why did it have to be snakes?
I feel the need for speed.
Back off, man. I'm a scientist.
I am your father.
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
Please, Scott!
Those lines weren't just quoted and referenced at office parties and backyard barbecues. They made their way into the political discourse. Remember, Ronald Reagan worked on the silver screen before moving into the White House. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Courtney Collins, in for Chris Boyd. In the Reagan era, cinema and politics seemed to blur together. Film critic Jay Hoberman explores that topic in his new book, Make My Day, Movie Culture in the Age of Reagan. And he joins us to talk about it. Jim, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
Before we talk about the Reagan era movies, let's talk about the kind of character Ronald Reagan played when he was an actor. With one exception, they were kind of similar, right?
Yeah, I mean, Reagan was a sort of second-tier leading man at Warner Brothers, and he was in genre films. I mean, he was in some cavalry films and westerns, but basically he played light romantic roles throughout the 1940s.
Was he pretty defensive of his acting career? I know he probably got questioned and maybe even teased a bit about films like Bedtime for Bonzo, where he starred alongside a chimp. How did he feel about his movies on the other side of them?
Yeah. Well, that one definitely he was kidded about, and he had a sense of humor about that. I think that he wasn't defensive about his career. I think that he loved it. I mean, I think in some respects... and this is something that I get into in the book, that Hollywood, being a Hollywood star, even a second-tier star, was the high point of his life. And, you know, he was over the hill a bit by the early 50s, so he didn't get as good roles, and it was mainly Westerns and action films and so on. But I don't think he was defensive about those either. I mean, you know, there's a joke that if he'd gotten better parts, he wouldn't have had to run for president.
I did not realize that Reagan had worked as a Screen Actors Guild union rep. What was he like in that role?
Well, he was looked out for his membership. I mean, this was during the period of the Red Scare, so he was responsible for rehabilitating screenwriters who had been leftists or communist sympathizers and so on, who were willing to give the names of their former comrades and so on, and, you know, help them get to work again. He also was responsible for buttressing the power of agents as opposed to the studios. Which, you know, say, he was very close with Lou Wasserman, was his agent, who then later became a very powerful production guy, head of Universal.
Now, this obviously wasn't a film role, but there's a really memorable part of the book where you kind of capture what that presidential debate between Reagan and Carter was like with a bit of theatrics. How did Reagan perform that night?
Well, you know, Reagan could be supremely relaxed. I mean... he was not at all intimidated by the fact that he was addressing, you know, millions of people on live TV. Carter crammed tremendously for that debate, and probably, you know, overstudied. I mean, he was Carter knew much more about the intricacies of policy than Reagan. But Reagan was able to be breezy and relaxed, and he basically won the debate when he said to Carter, I can't remember exactly what objection Carter made to something that he said, which shows you how powerful Reagan's rejoinder was when he just said, "There you go again." And that is what people remember to this day.
Yeah, I actually watched that clip this morning just to remind myself. I think they were talking about healthcare for all. And the audience's reaction to the "there you go again" is kind of stunning.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, people love that about him, that he could appear so offhand. But of course, he's an actor, so he could do that.
So I want to play a clip now from a movie that was described in your book as a fantasy in which the American middle class survives the onslaught of a monster to regain control of a vacation paradise.
A great white, Larry. A big one. And any shark expert in the world will tell you it's a killer. It's a man-eater.
Look, the situation is that apparently a great white shark has staked a claim in the waters off Amity Island. And he is going to continue to feed here as long as there is food in the water.
And there's no limit to what he's going to do. I mean, we've already had 3 incidents. 2 people killed inside of a week, and it's going to happen again. It happened before. The Jersey Beach.
1916, there were 5
people chewed up in the surf.
In 1 week.
Tell them about the swimmers.
A shark is attracted to the exact kind of splashing and activity that occurs whenever human beings go in swimming. You cannot avoid it.
So that, of course, was a clip from Jaws, came out in June of 75. What kind of a turning point or direction change did Jaws indicate for American movies?
Well, Jaws is a tremendously important landmark. I mean, first of all, you have to keep in mind that it came at the end of a cycle of what were called disaster films that began with Airport in 1970. And Jaws was also based on a book which had been a tremendous bestseller, so in a way it was pre-sold. And I'm leaving aside for the moment that it's an incredibly well-made movie and was superior in that sense to the earlier disaster films. But the studio, originally it was supposed to be a Christmas release, which is kind of crazy to think about it, but it was delayed, and it was released, you know, a saturation booking. I mean, you know, previously a movie like that might have been a roadshow, but Jaws was everywhere at once, like television, in June, just when people were going to the beaches, and it was a fantastic commercial success. Also, it was very scary. I mean, it was, you know, an excellent thriller, and you know, there's there's that aspect of it as well, but it really turned the industry around. I mean, for a movie to be making that much money in that little amount of time opened everybody's eyes, and they knew that in part it was because it was a pre-sold product, but it was something more than that.
What do you mean when you say that Spielberg was able to strip the disaster film down and turn it into a mechanism?
Well, that's a way of saying that it was an extremely proficient, almost ruthlessly proficient movie. I mean, the other disaster films, you know, Earthquake or Towering Inferno, had these kind of lumbering all-star casts, you know, a lot of, you know, fading stars or, you know, old stars and so on, and a lot of different storylines going on and so on. Jaws had basically 3 strong characters, Richard Dreyfuss, Robert Shaw, and the nominal hero, the cop, and it stuck with them throughout the whole film, and the conflicts were very, very clear. Also, I should say that Jaws made something apparent that was maybe harder to see in the other disaster films, and that is that you had this meretricious politician, the mayor of Amity, wants to open the beaches no matter what, despite the fact that the shark is there, and as a result of that, he precipitates a horrible situation, makes everything worse. I mean, it's almost like there's something Nixon-like about this guy. And if you look at the character, you can see they're even thinking about that. And the fact that the big catastrophe happens, I think, on July 4th. I mean, there's a lot going on to suggest that Amity is a kind of metaphor for the United States. And, you know, the movie doesn't belabor the point, but it's there. And I think that that added to its sense of relevance for audiences.
And I never really looked at the film that way either. But, I mean, you have Chief Brody. He's a cop. He's a family man. He's kind of all of us. And then, you know, he's able to do what the scientists and the experts and the fishermen and the corrupt politicians can't.
Well, yeah. And it's even if you want to parse these characters, it's even more than that, because, you know, one way to look at this movie, and it's a way that audiences would have been aware of, maybe not altogether consciously, but the Richard Dreyfuss character, who's the younger one, clearly would have been against the war in Vietnam. I mean, he was a student type, and whereas Robert Shaw was, you know, like a more of a working class hero, you know, and
you're talking about who plays Quint.
That's right, Quint. Right. And, you know, you could see that he might have been, you know, a defender of the war, of Nixon, of the status quo, and so on. The cop, who might also, at least in terms of his job, been a defender of the status quo, is a more ambiguous character. And he ultimately makes this alliance with the Dreyfuss character, you know, with the hippie, so to speak. And I think that's significant too. So it's like a new America is being reborn. I kind of associate that with the Carter coalition. You know, just a few years before, there were movies such as Joe, which was a kind of quasi-independent film, but an enormous hit, which played off hard hats versus hippies. And, you know, Jaws goes beyond that.
Why were Rocky and Raging Bull, we got two movies about boxers, such opposite movies?
Well, Rocky is, in a way, the prototype for all the feel-good movies from 1976, bicentennial year.
Mm-hmm. I should say, we are not just going to talk about the 80s. We're talking about movies that were produced in the 70s and early 90s as well. But yes, we got the bicentennial stuff cooking.
Yeah. Right to the present day. I mean, it was the ultimate feel-good movie, and it also created a kind of new ending for movies, which is still pretty popular, where the protagonist is just, you know, bathed in incredible goodwill and cheers. I mean, it's not just a happy ending, it's some kind of triumphant ending. And, you know, there's a lot of other stuff that one can say about Rocky, about, you know, the Cinderella story and the triumph of an underdog and so on. Whereas Raging Bull, a much more complicated movie, and also you can't compare them in terms of movie making skill. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, Raging Bull is just, you know, is you know, phenomenally well made and creative film. And acted and so on. But Raging Bull is what I would call a feel-bad movie. It has it has a character who's not likable at all. It ends with him having some kind of rehabilitation, but it's sort of a tawdry one. I mean, he's got this minor nightclub act where he does a bad imitation of Marlon Brando, who is himself playing a washed-up boxer and on the waterfront, so it's not exactly a happy ending, and it doesn't present the boxing itself as a way for anybody's you know, moral rehabilitation or, you know, financial success.
We're speaking this hour with Jay Hoberman. He's a legendary film critic who put in 30 years with The Village Voice. His book is called Make My Day, Movie Culture in the Age of Reagan. We'll be right back after a short break.
Thank you. call somebody.
That, of course, was a clip from E.T. the Extraterrestrial, which came out in 1982. We're speaking with Jay Hoberman, film critic and author of the book Make My Day, Movie Culture in the Age of Reagan. So E.T. wasn't just a movie. It was just a moneymaker across, seems like, all industries and brands once it came out.
Oh, yeah. It was a tremendous success and a universal favorite. And after E.T., even more than after Jaws, every movie studio wanted one.
I wanted an E.T., an extraterrestrial.
Yes, they wanted their own E.T.
And I remember being a child and going to, like, the ride at Universal Studios. But, I mean, you have reports in the book that even Reese's Pieces sales went up after E.T. because that was the candy that Elliot used to lure him into his house.
That's right. And evidently, M&M's, you know, didn't want to turn down whatever offer they got. And so Reese's Pieces, you know, picked it up.
So talk to me about what E.T. was saying. Elliot, the lead child, who was a suburban middle kid. Was he just like that perfect encapsulation of middle class values?
Well, in a way, I mean, Spielberg was kind of the poet of suburbia. I mean, he was really the first filmmaker to take the suburban lifestyle seriously and as a subject for his films. And the films were very heartfelt. So that's part of it. Also, one of the things that's going on in the 80s, both with Reagan and with Hollywood, is a kind of revision of the 1950s. And the movies that Spielberg and Lucas grew up on, if they were science fiction films, were almost entirely about hostile alien invaders. And, there were a few exceptions, which those filmmakers actually, and Reagan, liked. But mostly, you know, outer space was synonymous with danger and the enemy. And both Close Encounters and E.T. turned that completely around. I think that Close Encounters is kind of a more complicated film because it has an adult protagonist who, depending on how you look at it, I mean, he kind of regresses at the end. I mean, you know, if you think about what happens to him, he's beamed up into the mothership. But to have kids as the protagonists was a surefire thing. And it's an example of a movie that you might think was made for kids, but actually, you know, everybody enjoyed it. It was the most popular movie ever made for a while. And, it's in part because I think there's this sort of built-in innocence, which Spielberg was able to put on the screen in that film, certainly.
What do you mean when you say that E.T. is wildly protective of its own fantasy?
Well, okay. I think that the ambiguities of an alien creature, an absolute other, are difficult for us to come to terms with. I mean, which is one reason why it was so easy to envision dangers coming from outer space, whereas, you know, E.T., who is, if we look at it in our present terms, stranger than any possible refugee or immigrant or foreigner of any sort, a person of another religion, race, could be, is just embraced so totally by the kids, if not by the adults, which is why you have, you know, a certain aspect of reality entering in there. And, you know, the people who objected to E.T., I think that, you know, I have George Wills, the conservative commentator, was one of them, found this, you know, a really distressing, the idea that the scientists, you know, the government agents are the villains, and the kids somehow know more than they do. So,
Oh, yeah. I was going to say he doesn't like the whole adults are stupid, kids are smart.
That's right.
Phenomenon going on in that movie. And you don't go to school to just kill frogs, right?
Yes.
Tell me about Reagan's screenings of movies. I know you talk about this throughout the book. He consumed a lot of film while he was president. Sometimes he just watched stuff at Camp David with Nancy. Sometimes he hosted these private screenings. Was that typical? I don't know much about how presidents watch movies for the most part. Did he watch more than most?
Well, actually, Carter watched more movies. But Reagan's movie consumption is much more interesting. To me. And this is something that I got into as I was researching the book. And also, you know, I did some work at the Reagan Library and it really changed to some degree my thinking about him. I mean, my takeaway from that was how deeply involved he and his Nancy, who had also been in movies, mm-hmm. were in Hollywood still. I mean, that they really, you know, treasured their connection to it. So that said, he looked at all kinds of movies. You know, it was a mix of old movies and current movies, much more at Camp David. I mean, unlike previous presidents, he did not use the White House screening room that often for, you know, state occasions. And it's interesting what movies he did show there. Mm-hmm. E.T. was one, Reds was another. But basically, they would show movies at Camp David, and it would just be the president, the first lady, and their aides, and maybe one close friend, and you know, it was their together time, and they, you know, as I say, they looked at a variety of films, including their own, mm-hmm. That they were in, and he kept a diary, and he would sometimes have comments on these films. I found this, in some ways, quite illuminating, frustrating, because I would have liked to have known more of what he thought, but also illuminating. And the thing to keep in mind is that, you know, they were pros. They did not look at movies the way that any previous president or first lady would have. I mean, they were actors. They had a very different sense of what a movie was. But at the same time, and I think this is a sort of crucial to my understanding of them. You know, Reagan was in the movies, but the movies were in Reagan. Mm-hmm. He was a fan. I mean, he was a kind of true believer. And he, you know, he was in Hollywood during the high point of the industry, the 40s. And he grew up, he came of age during the Depression when movies were so important to people's lives. And I think that he carried that with him right through the presidency.
The E.T. screening was an interesting one because after the movie wrapped, didn't he stand up and say something like, oh, we know this is probably all true, and everyone laughed, but maybe he wasn't joking?
Well, who knows if he was joking or not? I mean, that's the, you know, he did make some comment. Spielberg likes to say that, oh, Nancy's, you know, she was crying, you know, and so on. The thing that we do know is that he did the next day have a briefing about the space program.
Tell me what you mean when you say that Indiana Jones, the character, is kind of the nice version of what someone in the 60s would have called an ugly American.
Ah, that's a very good question. And he's also an interesting sort of Reagan analog, although I don't think they were thinking about Reagan when they made the movie. I mean, he is, not to put too fine a point on it, you know, a kind of a plunderer of what we call the third world. There's this kind of neo-colonial adventure that's going on with him. I mean, you know, the key scene, the key moment really in the movie is the scene that's shot in the Cairo marketplace where he's menaced by some gigantic guy with a scimitar and he just like takes out his gun and shoots him, you know, point blank. I mean, just showing the superior technology, the Western technology. I mean, it's kind of like a stunning little compression of the settlement of the West or the, you know, American continent. At the same time, you know, he's very charming. You know, he's a handsome guy. You know, and he's gallant in his way. I mean, certainly he's in some sense on the right side of history. He's fighting the Nazis. And the movie also has this overlay. I mean, the whole idea, the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, at the end, It really seems like some kind of metaphor, intentional or unintentional, for the Manhattan Project, that they're struggling over, you know, nuclear power, atomic power here, and he prevails. So he's a he's almost like a mythic figure. He's a complicated figure, and but also one who's instantly recognizable as a as an American, despite the fact that he's a professor. You know, George Wallace would have called him a pointy-headed, you know, intellectual or something.
And it's interesting because throughout all the Indiana Jones movies, you know, he gets himself out of impossible scrapes in ridiculous ways and always finds what he's looking for and does it with charm. Did that, you know, let people in America kind of feel like we were triumphers on this international stage no matter what the unemployment rate was back at home?
Yeah, I think that it was flattering in that sense too. Yeah, I think that, you know, the Vietnam War, the way that the Vietnam War ended, you know, was a tremendous blow to America's self-esteem. I mean, this is something that's been you know discussed endlessly, and Raiders of the Lost Ark came out in 1981, so we're really only, you know, 6 years out from the end of the war. And to see this insouciant American adventurer so successful in what we would think of as like primitive cultures had to be a boost.
And that movie had been kind of germinating and marinating for a while, right? It had been an idea, and both George Lucas and Steven Spielberg were involved in getting it off the ground.
Yeah, and to follow on that point, I want to say that to me, these movies are not necessarily allegories. And sometimes if they are allegories, the allegory is not what I think is so compelling about them. I think that Reagan and Indiana Jones, or to use the example in the book, you know, the 1984 presidential campaign and the incredible success of Ghostbusters arrive out of the same thing. I mean, one doesn't create the other. They both, each in their own way, answer the same social need. So Spielberg and Lucas were incredibly attuned to popular culture. I mean, they were the most successful filmmakers of their day, and maybe of all time. So they clearly had a sense of what people wanted, and a great politician has that sense also.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. We're going to take a call now and go to Zachary in Austin. Zachary, you can go ahead with your question.
Hi. Yes. It was more of a comment. I agree with everything that we've heard today. You know, talking with my parents about film, I get the sense that, you know, by the time I came along in the early 80s, they were just really sick and tired of depressing 70s art house, you know, movies. You know, movies like, and so with this new, you know, wave of these positive, kind of simplistic, reductionist movies that they could also take the kids along to, that was perfect formula for them.
Do you agree with that? Was that the formula that people were looking for coming out of the 60s and 70s?
Yeah, I mean, Lucas said as much. He said that it had become depressing to go to the movies. I mean, this is, I think he said this after he had the success with American Graffiti, or it might have been before, but it certainly was before Star Wars. I mean, that was a deliberate attempt to offer an antidote. Stallone said the same thing about Rocky. I mean, he thought that, although in his sense it was he was objecting to the prevailing masculine ideal in Hollywood movies. You know, that these hero, anti-heroes, people, you know, guys who were conflicted or in some way were morally ambiguous characters. He wanted to present a totally positive hero, and I think that a lot of people felt the way that Zach's parents did. And this is something, this is a good example of something that Reagan would intuit without having to see these movies. I mean, he didn't need to see Rocky to grasp that America is, as this Dori Shary, a producer at MGM, once said, a happy ending nation. The movies of the late 60s and early 70s, which are very highly regarded by critics generally, are an anomaly in my opinion. And they arose from a time when, you know, the audience itself was very divided and the industry was very confused. And that's why movies like that could have been made.
And as you say in the book, Ronald Reagan wasn't trying to steer himself into a conscious belief of this. He truly did believe kind of in the happy ending and in Hollywood and in the cornball, as you say in the book. It was real for him.
Yeah. And this would be, you know, we can call this his particular genius. I mean, that he was able to intuit this, to feel his way into this. He knew how to play this part. And it wasn't altogether acting for him. I mean, another way to say it was that he was his own first convert to Reaganism.
What were some of the big tropes of the 1980s Hollywood scene?
Well, you know, one of the ones that E.T. introduced was the idea of, I think of it as The Stranger in Paradise. I mean, there are a number of movies where all kinds of aliens, you know, we might even call them illegal aliens, you know, show up in America. I mean, there's the E.T. from outer space. There were some others. There's Starman. There's the mermaid in Splash. There's Robin Williams as the Russian in Moscow on the Hudson. And these are just a few. There are others. And, you know, the movie shows them America shows us America through their eyes. And they love it. They love it. They see it's a paradise.
I'm speaking this hour with Jay Hoberman. He's a film critic, worked 30 years for The Village Voice. His new book is called Make My Day, Movie Culture in the Age of Reagan. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Of Sarah Connor. I was told that she's here. Could I see her, please?
No, can't see her. She's making a statement.
Where is she?
Look, it may take a while. You want to wait? There's a bench over there.
I'll be back.
That was a clip from The Terminator, which came out in 1984. Obviously, it feels almost silly introducing some of these, but we're speaking this hour with Jay Hoberman, who's a film critic, worked for The Village Voice for 30 years, and has written the book Make My Day, Movie Culture in the Age of Reagan. So there were a lot of star maker films kind of in the Reagan era, and I'm guessing The Terminator would definitely qualify as one of those.
Oh, definitely. In fact, I was smiling just to hear Arnold's delivery there. It still works. Yeah, I think that he became a star in that era. I mean, in the pop world, you know, Madonna and Michael Jackson are from that period. I mean, you know, MTV is as potent a star maker as Hollywood then. And a movie like The Terminator was innovative for its time, in part because of this, you know, very punchy graphics. I mean, it did have a kind of music video look to it. And I would also say that Terminator, I think, was a part of a group of movies that, in a funny sort of way, reacted against the Spielberg-Lucas sort of positive, optimistic view by putting forth much wilder and scarier sort of comic book imagery. I mean, Aliens, you know, James Cameron's second film is like that. You know, Cronenberg's remake of The Fly, RoboCop. These movies are much more, they're not simple feel-good movies, let me put it that way. There's an element of anxiety and social criticism in them.
Were there some movies in this era that kind of created that bleak dystopia in order for someone to be able to triumph over that? I mean, I know it's the opposite of The Stranger in Paradise, but if it's a whole bunch of strangers that are now the norm in what has become a bleakscape, there's something there.
Well, that's a great question, and I have to think which ones that might have been. So, but what did come to mind immediately was The Terminator was a sleeper. It was a movie that had very little advance hype and was a surprise hit. And it's the movie that was the number one movie in America the week before and the week after the 1984 presidential election. And the day or the week, you know, after the election, the LA Times, which is, of course, very, very synced into always, you know, what's going on in the movie industry, devoted, you know, the better part of their entertainment section to analyzing, you know, the political implications, you know, that the implications of the election in terms of the entertainment industry. And the film critic Charles Chaplin wrote about The Terminator, and he sort of saw it in exactly the way that you described it, as if this was a movie that like conjured up this dystopia and then dispelled it. So maybe that's an example of it. I myself think that the appeal was something else, but one could make that argument.
Why did Ronald Reagan love War Games so much?
Well,
the movie.
Yeah, the movie. Right. He was responsible for some other War Games too, but the movie. Well, I think that he liked the situation. I mean, you know, War Games. If people don't remember it, it's kind of like it's as if John Hughes, you know, remade Dr. Strangelove. If right. I'm not talking in code now, I mean, it's a movie about the potential obliteration, you know, a thermonuclear war that is a high school kid sets off and then is able to solve with his girlfriend. And I think that Reagan was intrigued by the idea that these computers maybe had a mind of their own, a life of their own. I mean, one thing I would say about Reagan is that I do believe that he was sincere in his, let's say, apprehension or even fear of nuclear war, despite the fact that he was often seen as a saber rattler or warmonger, so on. I think that this was something that he was concerned with, and so the movie appealed to him thematically. It's also probably not a coincidence that the script was written by the children of Hollywood friends of his. So he would have, but he liked the story, and he saw it, and he just was talking it up. I mean, it's, you know, he met with a bunch of senators. Have you seen this movie? And he's telling them the plot and so on, and they're amazed, you know, that he's doing this whole sales job. And he used it to tweak the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You know, could this really happen? Could some kid, you know, do this? You know, and I think that you know, for him, that might have been, this movie might have been, let's say, a more grown-up version of E.T., if you know what I mean, that it dealt with something that might have been actual in his life.
So how did Reagan use the movies, you know, overtly in his political life? We know he was kind of fond of invoking them in speeches and policy talks. Can you give some examples of those movie mentions that made their way into his discourse?
Oh, yeah. Well, the most famous, of course, I took for the title of the book. It was Irresistible. You know, when he quotes Dirty Harry, make my day. Although I think that there's another way. I mean, I hope that, you know, people see that also is that he made our day in the sense that, you know, manufactured something. He quoted from Back to the Future, which is, you know, another key movie of the period, where we're going. We won't need roads where we're going, or I forget exactly how it went.
Right.
Used that in the State of the Union. He did not come up with Star Wars. The Democrats and the press came up with that, and they thought it was derogatory. You know, no, it was great. I mean, he loved that. It didn't bother him at all that his plan would be identified with the most popular movie ever made. In fact, he ended one speech saying that's not Star Wars, but then said, and the Force will be with us. He just went ahead and quoted it again. I mean, he knew that that Rambo was a huge hit, and he brought it up after there was there were something that people have tended to forget about the 80s is there were a lot of terrorist incidents. Mm-hmm. I mean, many of them around hijacking. There was also the terrible thing that happened in Lebanon with a car bomb blowing up the American barracks and so on. I mean, it was a constant issue, terrorism. And after, like being involved in some very complicated negotiations to get some hostages freed, which also involved, getting help from Iran, and this is different apart from Iran-Contra. But he then, in his press conference said, "Well, I saw Rambo last night, and then next time I'll know what to do," which is a complete non sequitur. But it was like, people loved it. I mean, and there were all these posters, which maybe you can still find them on eBay, with this kind of muscle-bound Reagan. It looks like Stallone, and holding like a some sort of automatic weapon, and it's a Rambo, with a exclamation point.
And this isn't as overt, but you describe interestingly, one of the most dramatic moments, obviously, of Reagan's presidency was when he survived an assassination attempt. And you have kind of an interesting way that you described him leaving the hospital not very long after he was shot.
Yeah, well, he remembered all these lines from movies. I mean, I think this is, more than anything else, this is what endeared him to the public. And, by surviving an assassination, he really closed the book on, what people perceive this as a curse, the 20 years, every 20 years somebody will die in office, something, this kind of thing. But really what it did was there had been a succession of every presidential election since 1964 had been decided by or influenced by an assassination. And even in 1976, there were two attempts made on the life of Gerald Ford. So, shooting the president or shooting a politician seemed to be, baked into our democracy at that point. And the fact that he survived was, enormously important. That said, this jaunty attitude that he had, that the fact that he was able to, keep remembering, it's telling his wife, "Oh, honey, I forgot to duck," or telling the doctors, "Oh, I hope you're all Republicans," or, say, "Well, all things considered, I'd rather be in Philadelphia." He remembered these almost like vaudeville lines. And, they might have been corny in a movie, but they were not corny when the president who had, came within an inch of losing his life said them.
You're listening to Think. I'm Courtney Collins in for Chris Boyd. We're going to go back to the phones and talk to Tom in Houston. Tom, go ahead.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Good, enjoying the show so much. Just want to ask the guest what he feels is the best era for movie making so far. And also, on top of that, what he thinks of the movies of this century, the 21st century.
Okay. That's a lot. I mean, I'll...
But, capsule versions, I guess. Yeah. Capsule reviews.
But I best, I don't know. I can tell you what my favorite periods are. I mean, I really love the movies of the early 1930s before the production code took hold, because I think that the movies were raw and daring. I mean, I find those very enjoyable. And I also like the movies of the 60s and 70s. And, I was a teenager or a young person then. So, of course, I would like those movies. And, that's an anomalous period. Now, this century, I am a recovering film critic. So I don't go to the movies all the time. And certainly I don't go, constantly as I did for many years. So I'm not really up to date with everything. I got sick of superhero movies, pretty early. Sorry if that's, but I just, and that's okay. I mean, but it wasn't of great interest to me. I would say that the best thing that I've seen recently is the Quentin Tarantino film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and that is in one sense a nostalgic movie. I understand that, but also a movie that I think is really steeped in what it is that people want from movies, want from Hollywood, and I wouldn't want to spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen it. So I won't say anything more about it. But he's a terrific filmmaker. I haven't liked all of his movies, or maybe even most of them, but I did like that one a lot.
Speaking of nostalgia, I read an interview with you where someone asked you if you had seen Stranger Things, and you said, is that a podcast?
This is embarrassing. Right, yeah.
So you're not up to date on all the streaming nostalgia that is everywhere?
No. I tend not to... I do look at things on disc, but I don't look at that much streaming, and even cable. I thought that the Sopranos was magnificent, but that's already pretty old.
So you told us in the book that Donald Trump toyed with going to film school before joining the real estate biz.
So that's what I've heard. That's what I saw reported, and I found that irresistible. I mean, certainly he has always been attracted to show business. And Trump is a whole nother thing. There's really a lot to say about him in conjunction with Reagan. One might think that that he's a continuation of Reagan, and in some ways he is, but he's also Reagan's antithesis, because Reagan, as a creature of Hollywood and somebody who had internalized Hollywood's values, wanted to build the largest possible audience. I mean, was involved with a certain kind of consensus, or doing things that the majority of the people liked. Trump, who comes out of a different show business tradition, not just reality TV, but talk radio and cable news and so on, is not interested in doing that. I mean, interested in dividing the audience.
So I'll let you finish the thought. If Reagan's movie was America, what's Trump's movie?
Trump's movie is Trump.
We're speaking this hour with Jay Hoberman, film critic who spent 30 years at The Village Voice. His work has also appeared in the New York Times and The Nation. His book is called Make My Day, Movie Culture in the Age of Reagan. Jim, thank you so much for your time. What a great conversation.
Oh, well, thank you very much for inviting me.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. Once again, I'm Courtney Collins, in today for Chris Boyd. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great day.